hard-edged, bitter, almost a grimace. A wise move, pirate. Never accept a drink from me. I am the midwife who delivers the king's enemies into hell.
Destin swirled the liquid in his glass and drank it down, his throat jumping. The message seemed clear.
I am not for you, and you are not for me. Am I one of the king's enemies, Des?
Evan asked softly.
Well, there is a heavy price on your head, Destin said,
studying his empty glass, as if deciding whether to refill it.
However, as an official of the king, I'm not allowed to collect.
Too bad, Evan said.
He lifted the hammer and tongs amulet from around his neck, wadded the chain in his hand, and extended it toward Destin.
Thank you for the loan of your amulet.
Keep it, Destin said, waving it away.
I replaced it a long time ago.
Evan slipped the chain over his head, pleased to feel the familiar weight of the flash against his skin. He fished a small velvet bag from inside his coat and slid it across the table, feeling like a suitor offering a series of unworthy gifts.
I saved your mother's ring and locket for you.
He pulled a leather-wrapped bundle from his carry bag and set it next to the rest.
And your father's dagger, in case you wanted that too.
Surprise cleared the bitterness from Destin's face.
You...
He stopped, swallowed hard, and brushed his long fingers across the leather, then met Evan's gaze for the first time.
Thank you. It's my mother's dagger, actually, he said,
a bit of color staining his pale cheeks.
My father took it away from her the first time she tried to defend herself.
He paused, as if steeling himself to go on.
She's alive, you know. My mother, I mean, if you can call it that.
Evan sat forward, a spark of hope kindling in his middle.
Frances is alive.
Destin nodded.
She lives with her family in Tamron.
Memories flooded in, Frances asking Evan to stay on and be a friend to her son.
I think you both have lessons to teach each other.
Frances, saying to Destin,
I've lost so much. I don't want to lose you, too.
Can I? I would love to see her again.
No,
Destin said, with a bleak finality.
You wouldn't. Leave well enough alone.
That seemed to be the theme of the entire conversation.
Then why have a meeting at all?
What about your father?
Still living,
Destin said.
Why?
Evan met Destin's eyes directly.
If you're such a dangerous, despicable, ruthless person.
He's not the king's enemy, Destin said.
Not yet.
He shifted his eyes away and methodically refilled his glass.
Why do you think he brought my mother back alive? The general has made it clear that if anything happens to him, Frances and her family will pay a dear price. But he knows it's a card he can play only once, so right now, it's a standoff. He'd better get down on his knees every night and pray for their good health.
I'll kill him for you if you want, Evan said. Though, admittedly, it would be easier if you could lure him to the coast. Even better, suggest a father-son fishing trip.
Destin laughed, low in his throat.
Thank you, pirate, he said. But killing is something I'm actually quite good at. The general is mine. I can wait.
He fingered Breaker's ears, ruffling up his fur.
Is it my imagination, or has my dog joined the Bloodsworn? I couldn't help noticing that he and your crew share a certain reddish glow.
It's not your imagination, Evan said, though I prefer the term Stormborn.
He explained what had happened at the cottage and after.
So, how does it work, this blood magic?
Evan hesitated. He hadn't shared this with anyone else. It wasn't something he was particularly proud of.
It is a magic I share with the Empress. My blood has the power to raise the recent dead and nearly dead. Once raised, the Stormborn are fearless, exceedingly strong, impervious to pain, and unflinchingly loyal. The perfect soldier, Destin murmured. There is a price to be paid, Evan said. They lose some of their mental edge, creativity, decision-making ability and the like, and the desire for more blood never leaves them. I'm surprised at you, Destin said, his face mingling grudging respect and a trace of surprise. You used to be annoyingly ethical. I'm a pirate, not a priest, Evan snapped. Most of my crews are converts from the Empress's Bloodsworn that I bind with my blood. That takes them out of Celestine's hands and delivers to me the most experienced sailors and fighters. They also know her weaknesses and strengths. Is that how you justify it?
Destin raised an eyebrow. Same eyebrow, same way. Joltingly familiar.
They are all given a choice. Stay with the Empress and die, or serve me and live. Most don't find it a difficult decision.
Evan took a breath, forcing his muscles to relax. There was no reason to be defensive. It was just Destin, pulling whatever chain he could get hold of.
I do what's necessary to stay alive and make a living. Tarvos is thriving. I've made it into a sanctuary and fortress that the Empress can't breach. The Guardians stand watch when I am not there. So you figured out how to use them?
Destin said, brightening.
Did that manuscript I found... That manuscript you found was a lifesaver, Evan said. Thank you. What about Celestine? Any meetups with the Empress in the north?
Destin toyed with his mother's dagger, as if half listening, but something in the way he said it suggested he was striking close to the bone.
She used to stalk me continually, every time I put to sea, Evan said. After losing several ships, she learned to keep her distance, for fear of being swamped. However, I believe the price on my head in Karthus is higher than the one your king is offering, which is why I need a crew I can trust.
Destin studied Evan's face, the heat of his scrutiny bringing the blood up under his
skin. It seems what I've been hearing about you is true. That depends, Evan said. What have you been hearing? I am the spymaster for the king now, pirate. I have eyes and ears across the Indio. They call you the Stormcaster of the desert coast and the Scourge of the wetlands. They say you're the only one who still defies the Empress in the east. They say you are ruthless.
Evan half shrugged, oddly touched that Destin had been keeping track of him.
I suppose you could still call me the Lord of the Ocean, but Celestine has gobbled up nearly all the land. Sooner or later I have to put into a port, and the only stronghold I have along the desert coast is Tarvos. Even that's becoming more and more dangerous.
He paused, then forged ahead.
When you called me here, I thought maybe you intended to cash in.
No, Destin said, but it does have to do with the Empress. He released a long breath.
You see, a few months ago, my king sent me to Delphi to hunt down a girl with a mage mark.
Evan listened with growing alarm as Destin told his story. He'd always known this would happen. Sooner or later the Empress would run down her quarry and add another weapon to her armory. but to know it was actually happening was like a bolt to the heart. Her name is Jenna? Evan found himself wishing that he'd accepted Destin's offer of a drink. That's the name she goes by now. Jenna Bandelow. Bandelow, Evan repeated, as if that would deliver some insight. That was not a name that Celestine had mentioned the day they'd first met, but then again, she'd only named the ones she'd already found. You've seen her, Mage Mark? Destin nodded. He pulled out a folded paper and handed it over. This is the sketch the king gave me. Evan studied it. The jewel in the center? It appears to be a ruby. And there's this. Destin reached under the table and retrieved a black leather case. Setting it between them, he opened it, revealing a curved Carthian blade like the ones carried by Celestine's horse lords. It was left to Jenna, supposedly by her mother. She killed one of the king's guard in Delphi with this blade. When Evan reached for it, Destin gripped his wrist, hard. Evan looked up, startled, all but undone by the pressure of Destin's fingers against his pulse point. For a long moment, they stared at each other. Careful you don't cut yourself, Destin said. It's magicked. Jenna stabbed herself with it and nearly died. One heartbeat. Two heartbeats. Then he let go. But it was too late. Destin had shown his hand. It had been a huge risk to contact Evan, to hold this meeting, to commit treason against the king he served. It proved that, despite his claims to the contrary, the connection between them remained. Destin hadn't moved on either. Evan swallowed hard, undone by the gratitude that welled up inside him. He wrenched his mind back to the conversation. Jenna nearly died, but she is alive. Destin nodded. She's recovering. The king has sent word to the Empress, but I took steps to make sure it would take a long time to get there. Still, at best we have a few weeks before Celestine comes to collect, maybe less. Evan was ambushed by a mixture of hope and dread. A few weeks. They had a few weeks. He had to find a way to... You've questioned this, Jenna? Destin nodded. I used persuasion on her, but it doesn't seem to work. As you'll recall, it doesn't work on you either. Still, I've interrogated a lot of people, and I think she was telling the truth when she said she had no idea what the mage mark means. Hope diminished just a bit. What are her gifts? Destin frowned, as if trying to remember every detail. As I said, she's resistant to magery. She claims to be clairvoyant, that she sometimes sees images of the future, sees people as they really are, or can tell when someone is lying. She claims that her senses are sharper than most. Vision, hearing, sense of smell. She heals quickly, and is resistant to flame. In fact, she develops a kind of armor for protection. Evan shook his head, bewildered. He couldn't put those details together into any kind of theory that made sense. But maybe, together, they could... Destin rolled his glass between his hands. If worse comes to worst, I could kill her before the Empress arrives, but... No! Evan all but shouted. The door banged open, and Brody, Jorani, and Tezza crowded into the doorway. My lord, Tezza said. Is everything all right? Everything is fine, Evan said. I'm sorry. We were just having a political discussion. Jorani gave Destin the evil eye, and then they withdrew. Back to Jenna, Evan said. I don't want to kill her. I want to save her if I can. I have to talk to her. I've never met anyone else like me. I just... Destin raised both hands. Calm down, pirate. I guessed that you would. So
I do have another plan. It's a terrible, foolhardy, hastily made plan that will probably get us both killed. It involves the weapon I asked you to bring with you. He paused. You did bring a weapon, didn't you?
Evan nodded. I brought a sun dragon. Destin stared at him.
A sun dragon?
Evan nodded.
It's still rather small, but it's growing fast. We need to act before it outgrows the hold. You weren't worried that it would set fire to your ship?
It came with a flashcraft collar that blocks magic, Evan said. He paused, then continued eagerly.
Would you like to see it?
Destin laughed, his first deep, genuine laugh of the day. And suddenly, they were back in Tarvos, two boys laying plans and building their ship of dreams.
God's pirate, I have missed you, Destin said, shaking his head. Let's go see this dragon, and I'll go over the plan.
Chapter 15 Debriefing. Hal Madelon crawled forward on his belly until he could look over the edge of the cliff. The wind off the Indio drove a freezing rain inland in sheets, plastering his hair to his head, running under his collar and down his neck, and dripping off the tip of his nose. Below and to the south lay the city and harbor of Chalk Cliffs. His heart sank when he saw that the same siren flag flew over the battlements as had flown over the ships that attacked the city a scant few days ago. It was what he had expected, but still disappointing. The harbor was packed with ships, and the waterfront seethed with activity despite the rain, like an anthill that's been overturned. The invaders were wasting no time offloading soldiers, horses, and supplies. Horsemen rode up and down the beach in their thickly padded coats, head wraps, and knee-length breeches. They carried the curved swords they'd used so effectively on the city battlements. Some wore bits and pieces of Highlander uniforms, along with traditional garb. Corporal Sasha Talbot eased up beside him. She stared down at the scene for a long moment, swore softly, then blotted at her eyes with her sleeve. She cleared her throat.
"That answers that," she said. "It looks like they mean to stay a while."
Hal nodded, watching her out of the corner of his eye. The statuesque blue jacket had been subdued and gloomy since the city fell, and the Empress Celestine sailed off with the heir to the Grey Wolf throne. At least she no longer talked about drawing her sword and charging down into the midst of the horse-lord pirates, taking out as many as she could before she went down herself. "She blames herself," he thought, "and I blame myself." He guessed there was more than enough blame to go around.
"Do you see any of ours?"
he said, focusing on the scene below. Talbot slowly turned her head and stared at him.
"Yours, I mean," he amended quickly.
He and Talbot got on fairly well, except for the fact that she still considered him to be a prisoner of the crown. At least she'd allowed him to keep the weapons he'd collected off a dead soldier. Talbot looked again, then murmured,
"Oh, I think they've got some of ours repairing the fortifications."
Hal saw it now, teams of workers hauling rock under the supervision of the riders. It seemed that one of them wasn't moving fast enough, because his horse lord guard unslung his blade and cut him down. Talbot swore again.
"I wish we could help them."
She fingered the hilt of her sword.
"Come back with an army," Hal said quickly. "Then you can help them."
Talbot grunted.
"I don't know if we can field an army that can stand against them,"
she said, her expression bleak.
"Buck up, Talbot,"
Hal said, punching her lightly on the shoulder.
"It's not like you to surrender before the battle begins." "I've never fought soldiers like these," she said.
Hal knew she was second-guessing every move she'd made, all the choices that resulted in the loss of her captain, her princess, her friend. Hal was doing a lot of that himself.
"We'll be ready for them next time," Hal said. "They may be fierce and fearless, but they'll bleed like any other soldier."
"I'm not so sure," Talbot said.
She shot Hal a defiant look, as if daring him to contradict her. Hal fully intended to bring that same story to his father, but he knew better than to go before the Thane unprepared. He needed more information.
"Stay here," Hal said. "I'll be right back."
When he began scrambling back away from the cliff, Talbot gripped his arm.
"Where do you think you're going?"
"I'm going to go down and see if I can find out a little more about who we're up against."
"What if you don't come back?"
Hal struggled not to lose his temper.
"If I don't come back, I'll be dead. But you'll be alive, so you can go tell your Captain Byrne and your Queen what's going on."
Talbot scowled, but released her hold. Hal crept south along the cliff until he found an icy stream bed where he could descend to the beach. Once on the sand, he threaded his way forward between huge chalk slabs until he could get a clear view. The horses were being ferried ashore in small boats south of the high cliffs and kept in temporary paddocks until they could be moved into the city. They were not the dun-colored Ardenine military mounts Hal was used to, nor the sturdy, shaggy ponies used in the Highlands. These horses had chiseled heads, arched necks, and long legs, and they carried their tails high. A sentry leaned on the paddock fence, watching the progress of a longboat back to the ship anchored offshore. Unlike most of the others, he was bareheaded. He wore his hair in a long plait that extended nearly to his waist, though the top of his head was shaved clean. His beard was also braided and decorated. He wore light armor over loose-fitting clothing. More than anything, he resembled the horse lords from the desert realms across the Indio. Hal was still debating whether to kill him outright or to try to take him alive and risk giving himself away, when the rattle of pebbles on stone behind him alerted him to danger. He dove sideways in time to avoid being beheaded by the curved blade of the horse lord who'd crept up on him. Hal rolled to his feet, his sword in one hand, a fistful of sand in the other. He managed to block his attacker's next swing, but the force of the blow all but rattled the teeth from his head. Hal was no slouch, but it didn't take long for him to realize that he was outmatched. The horse lord was strong as an ox, and yet so quick on his feet that Hal could scarcely do more than dodge and feint, rarely getting in a blow of his own. The horse lord's next swing all but disarmed Hal, but the curved blade caught against his own, and Hal took that opportunity to come in close enough to fling the sand in the horse lord's eyes. When his blade dropped away, Hal drove his sword beneath his ribcage, all the way to the hilt. The horse lord smashed his gauntleted arm across Hal's face, pitching him backward onto the sand. Then the other sentry was there, his blade at Hal's throat, pinning him to the beach. Hal watched in horror as the man he'd skewered yanked the blade free and tossed it aside on the sand.
"No," Hal thought, spitting out blood. "That wound is not survivable, let alone ignorable. Not by any mortal man. I need to apologize to Talbot for questioning her description of the invading army. The way things were going, he might never get the chance."
The two enemy soldiers were arguing now, in a language akin enough to common, that Hal realized they were arguing over whether to kill him now or deliver him to the Empress alive. If they took him to the Empress, would Lissa Gray be there? Could he devise a way to rescue her and the busker?
"You know the Empress will want this one alive,"
one of the horse lords said, pointing at Hal, and then toward the ship.
"He is young and strong, and a good fighter."
The skewered man fingered the hilt of his sword and scowled at Hal. The man's jaw was set stubbornly, as if he took being skewered rather personally.
Celestine has many new recruits to choose from, Hoshua, he said. She can spare this one. She will need many more blood sworn in the coming days, Hoshua said. These wetlands have plenty of seasoned soldiers. They have been at war for years.
Wetlands, Hel thought. That must mean that they are from the drylands across the sea. And what did that mean, Bloodsworn? Was it simply the name used for the Horse Lord fighters, or did it have something to do with their superhuman strength and stamina?
I don't want to have to keep watch on him all the way to Seliskard, the wounded man said.
Where is Seliskard? Is that where they would have carried Lyssa Gray?
Don't worry, Enemish. We can chain him below decks. He won't be any trouble.
After a heated discussion, his captors finally agreed that maybe the Empress could spare this one particular soldier.
Take me to Celestine,
Hal said in common, startling the two horse lords, who looked down at him as if a rock on the beach had begun speaking. These Bloodsworn might be relentless, but they were not particularly quick-witted. Enevish, the skewered man, drew back his foot and kicked him. The movement caused the horse lord to stagger a bit, as if his body was catching up to the fact that it was in serious trouble. That's when Hal heard a familiar thwack. Now an arrow shaft was centered in Hoshua's chest. Hal rolled onto his side, gripped Anubish's boot, and gave it a hard twist. Bone cracked, and the horse lord went down. Focus on breaking bones, Hal thought. That makes them less mobile. Hal scrambled over the sand where Enevish had dropped his sword, scooped it up, and turned to see Hoshua bearing down on him, as unconcerned about his arrow as Enevish had been about being run through. The bow sounded again, and the horse lord stumbled as a second arrow hit him in the back. Hal took advantage of the distraction to behead his opponent with a two-handed swing. The head splashed into the water, but the body continued to stagger around, spraying blood from its severed neck until it tripped over a rock slab and went down.
Madelon, look out!
Hal turned, and Talbot was sprinting toward him, knocking an arrow as she ran. Between them, Enevish was crawling across the sand toward Hal, pulling with his arms, pushing with one leg, and dragging the broken one, his dagger in his teeth. In desperation, Hal threw his shoulder against a slab of rock, toppling it over so Enevish was pinned underneath. Breathing hard, Hal bent down, resting his hands on his knees, and tried not to spew sick all over the sand. Talbot knelt next to Enabish's head. She swore softly.
"He's dead," she said, glaring at Hal. "I wanted to interrogate him."
"Sorry," Hal muttered. "But I, questioned him before he died."
Talbot eyed him suspiciously.
"What do you mean? What did you find out?"
It was the first time he'd interrogated someone from the wrong end of a sword, but he knew more now than he had before.
"They're Empress Celestine's army," Hal said. "They sail out of her capital at Seliskard, wherever that is. That's where they likely took the Busker and Captain Gray."
Hal and Talbot chose new mounts from among the long-legged desert horses in the temporary paddocks on the beach. They stole weapons and other gear from the dead horse lords. Hal wasn't in love with the curved blades the pirates carried, but now he knew from experience that they were good at removing heads with a single swipe, which seemed to be one of the few ways to put these demon soldiers down for good. Their bows were strange also, lightweight, with limbs that curved back toward the archer. Hal was good with a crossbow, and fair with a longbow, but it would take practice to learn how to use one of these. They rode west toward Fortress Rocks, continuing until their horses were exhausted. When they didn't dare push them any further, they found lodging at an inn along the road. To say they found lodging was being generous. The inn was already packed with refugees heading inland. Hal and Talbot slept in the barn, in a stall with three other people. Talbot had a small amount of money, but all Hal had were a handful of unfamiliar coins he'd taken from Enabish. To say they slept was being generous. Hal rose at first light and saddled his horse. He'd named the stallion Bosley because he was bulky, full of himself, and obsessed with getting at the mares. Hal filled the panniers with food for several days, his quiver with arrows, and lashed a blanket roll behind his saddle. He was swinging open the barn doors when Talbot appeared, her hair in a tangle, wiping sleep from her eyes.
"Where do you think you're going?"
she demanded, her hand on the hilt of her sword.
"This is where we say goodbye."
Hal led his mount out into the stable yard, with Talbot hard on his heels.
"What do you mean, goodbye?"
Talbot planted herself in his path.
"You're coming with me to Fortress Rocks, and then on to Fell's March. The Queen will want to question you along with me."
"I have business in Arden," Hal said. "I need to go home."
"You are a prisoner of the Queen," Talbot said, "and it's not my place to decide to set you free."
"I won't tell if you don't," Hal said, but she didn't crack a smile.
He sighed. It was unfair for her to keep playing by the book when he'd already strayed so far from it.
"After what we've faced together in Chalk Cliffs, do you really want to shed blood between us?"
He knew Talbot well enough by now not to suggest whose. He swung up into the saddle, and Talbot gripped the stallion's cheekpiece. Never a good idea where Bosley was concerned. He showed his teeth, jerking his head to one side so that she lost her hold. Hal reined in, forcing the stallion back a few steps. Talbot drew her sword.
"I like you, Madelon," she said, "but I can't just let you ride back home when you are a prisoner of war."
"We're all prisoners of war, aren't we?" Hal said, but that gained him no ground. He leaned down toward her, using all the persuasion at his command, which, admittedly, wasn't much.
"Look, I know you don't want to go back to your queen and report that you lost your commanding officer, your post, and your prisoner. If I had my way, I would go after that ship, even if I had to row all the way to Seliskard."
By now, Talbot was nodding her agreement.
"But," he said, which stopped her nodding, "I'm tactician enough to know that the only thing I'd likely achieve by doing that is an early grave. We need more information, we need more firepower, and the only connections I have are in Arden. Holding me hostage and hoping my father responds for the first time in his life is a waste of time. I can do your queen and your queendom a lot more good by going home and making a case in person than by cooling my heels in a dungeon in Fellsmarch."
"How exactly could you do us good?" Talbot asked, scowling. "And why would you once you're home?"
Hal had lots of possible answers. "Because I've fallen for your Captain Gray? Because when it comes to choosing between her and the despicable Montaignes, it's no choice at all. Because I've never seen a people so devoted to their line of queens. Because, after swimming for so long in the political swill of Arden's court, I've gotten used to breathing clean air here in the north. Because I'm a fool for lost causes.
Captain Gray and I had an argument about the war," Hal said. "I told her flat out you were going to lose. I told her we had better weapons, a bigger army, deeper pockets, and an entire empire to draw upon. It's a total mismatch. Only a fool would bet on you."
Talbot's face was getting redder and redder.
"And she said..."
He laughed.
"She disagreed."
"What's your point, Madelon?"
"The point is, now, I'm not so sure.
Winning a war depends on more than armament and numbers. An army can't fight on heart alone, but it can't fight without it either. That said, the Empress Celestine and her army of bloodsworn scare the hell out of me. I've never seen soldiers like them. From what Enebish said, she has an endless supply. After Chalkcliffs, I am sure of one thing. If the realms cannot unite against the threat from the east, we will all lose. Talbot nodded grudgingly. Maybe so, but if you think that after 25 years of war, Queen Rhaessa is going to bend the knee to the Empire, you're wrong. I didn't say the Empire. I said the realms. Give your queen my regards. With that, Hal set his knees to the stallion's sides. As he rode away, he was reasonably sure that Talbot wouldn't put an arrow in his back, mostly because she didn't have a bow in her hands. Still, the tension didn't leave his back and shoulders until he rounded a turn and was out of sight. Chapter 16 Prodigal Son. Hal rode south over the Alyssa Plateau, taking the path he'd traveled after his escape from the debacle at Queen Court. He crossed into Arden, west of Spirit Gate, but he didn't feel any safer on the southern side of the border. For all he knew, the Empress was attacking ports up and down the coast. For all he knew, he was a hunted man in Arden. Once he was well into Arden, he began asking questions about the state of the dispute between the king and the Thane Council. But when your sources are tavern gossip, you get creative and conflicting stories. Some said King Jarrett had freed all political prisoners and was negotiating with the Thanes in a new spirit of collaboration. Some said that the full power of the army of Arden would take the field against the Thanes any day now. Another common line was that Queen Marina had seized power and was running the kingdom in the name of her son. Still others expected that Jarrett's betrothal would be announced any day, bringing one of the powerful Thane families to his side, if not Jarrett's, then his sister's. In short, the information was as reliable as tavern gossip usually is. Nobody recalled hearing anything about Lady Madelon or her daughter, but almost everyone had heard that Thane Madelon and his surviving son were gathering troops in the countryside. Hal wondered if word had reached his father that he was alive and held captive by the Grey Wolf Queen, or if the messages the Wolf Queen had promised to send had been intercepted by his family's enemies, or if she'd sent any messages at all. He considered taking ship from Spirit Gate to Middlesea, but given what he'd seen at Chalk Cliffs, he decided to stay as far away from the coast as possible. He traveled overland, hoping that the passes through the Heartfangs would be open by now. Anyone keeping watch for him wouldn't expect him to come that way. After a series of frustrating delays due to the dregs of an especially hard winter, he made it through the mountains in time to meet spring as it climbed the western slopes. Hal methodically stripped off layers of clothing as the snows thinned, then disappeared from all but the shadiest spots. After a year in Delphi and his winter travels through the frozen north, the scent of earth and flowers went to his head like the 10-year brandy his father reserved for special occasions. His desert horse, Bosley, seemed as pleased as Hal to be leaving the cold mountains behind. Now Hal looked down over the valley that he'd called home from birth. Though he hadn't spent much time here since he'd left for the army at the age of 11, it was still the center of his personal compass. He scanned the scene below, looking for signs of disorder. The river was out of its banks, but that wasn't unusual this time of year, when the melting snows in the mountains sent waterfalls roaring down the lower slopes of the Heartfangs. The runoff fed the northern branch of the Arden's water that joined her southern sister on the way to the sea.
From the looks of things, the tenants had already been working the close-in shares. New crops greened the better allotments near the river. But other, less fertile fields lay fallow, suggesting that some who normally worked the fields might have been turned to bloodier work. At least the keep wasn't ringed by armies flying the Red Hawk, and the manor house still stood intact amid his lady mother's gardens. The dying sun colored the low hills to the west, and smoke curled from the kitchens that would be preparing the evening meal. The joy of homecoming was tempered by the knowledge that his mother and sister weren't there. Nudging his horse into motion, Hal began his descent. He'd only just reached the flatlands at the bottom when he saw horsemen riding hard toward him. Hal rested his hand on his curved sword until the riders were close enough that he could see that they wore the spreading oak signia pinned to their clothes. Militia, then, not his father's regulars. Hal didn't see any familiar faces. Nobody seemed to recognize Hal, either. And why would they? He was a scruffy stranger on a stolen horse carrying an exotic blade. The horses were motley, and the riders were, too. So Hal guessed they were farmers and farmers' sons, called into service. All except for their officer, a corporal who rode a fine horse with elaborate trappings and looked to be about 12 years old. He wore a different signia than the others, the shield and cross. Hal racked his brain, trying to recall what house that was.
"State your name and business," the baby officer said. "You crossed into Lord Madelon's holdings."
Before Delphi, Hal would have freely volunteered his name and business at the border of his father's lands to people wearing his signia. But he did not know for sure who these people were, and he developed some skills at staying alive off the battlefield as well as on it.
"I'm here to see Lord Madelon," Hal said, holding on to his own name for the moment. "Is that so?"
The corporal looked him up and down, taking in Hal's stubble of beard and his travel-stained clothing.
"Why would he want to meet with you?" "That's between me and Madelon," Hal said. "Then you should know that he's not here."
"Then where is he?" Hal was tempted to say. Instead, he said,
"Of course he's not here. He's going to meet me here in 2 days' time." "Then come back in 2 days," the boy said. "What's your name, Corporal?"
Hal barked it with enough authority that the boy replied before he thought it through.
"It's Roland Delacroix," he said.
"Son of Pascal?"
The boy blinked at Hal, as if surprised he would know the name.
"Yes, he's my father."
That was it. The shield and cross belonged to the Delacroix, though a bunch of grapes and a cask would be more accurate. They were a family of wine merchants, originally from Tamron, highly skilled at avoiding any actual service in the war, which was why Hal hadn't recognized their signia at first. There was something else, though. Hal tightened his grip on the hilt of his sword.
"Brother to Estelle, then?"
Estelle Delacroix was mistress to King Gerard, and her family had prospered when she became his favorite. Hal usually didn't follow court gossip, but he knew all this courtesy of his mother's and sister's newsy letters while he was in exile in Delphi. The letters had stopped, of course, when Delphi fell and the Madelon women were taken hostage, so he was no longer up to date. Roland flushed scarlet.
"Estelle was my sister, yes, until swiving King Gerard executed her for treason, like she would try to kill him by putting an adder in her own bed. How stupid would that be?"
Roland clapped his mouth shut then, as if realizing how much he was revealing to this scruffy stranger and a dozen onlooking farmers.
"I'm sorry to hear about your sister," Hal said, and meant it. "So what are you doing here? Has your family allied with White Oaks?"
"White Oaks has allied with us," Roland said loftily. I've been charged with organizing local forces to protect the keeps in the area while my father and his allies march on the capital.
Your father's with them, then? Hal wanted to say. That would be a first. Has anyone explained which end of the sword to stick them with? Instead, he said,
Have you heard any news about Lady Madelon and the other hostages?
Roland shook his head.
If you want my opinion, they're all dead, he said. How foolish was that, to gather in the capital like that with their families? They were sitting ducks. As soon as things went sour with Estelle, we withdrew to our holdings in the east to await developments.
Roland focused in on Hal's face, and it seemed he saw something dangerous there, because he paled and pulled back on his horse's reins, retreating a few steps.
So, he went on, now that I've been so frank with you, you can see that we've not to feed nameless travelers.
What about one with a name, then? Hal said. They call me Halston Madelon, son of Arshel and Lady Marjorie Scoville, and brother to Robert and Harper.
Madelon!
Roland stared at him, his mouth dropping open. Once alerted, even Roland couldn't fail to see the resemblance between Hal and his father.
But you're the dead one.
Not yet, Hal said. Hopefully, not for a while. Chapter 17. Two pirates walk into a bar. The Icelands would be a better name for this country than the Wetlands, Evan thought, especially in this cold season. He and his crew had traveled south to Spirit Gate, hoping to avoid the snow-stuffed high passes by taking a more southerly road west into the interior. Their chosen route led through the borderlands, skirting the southern flank of a massive peak that was hidden in cloud most of the time. The southerners called it the Harlot, the northerners Mount Alyssa. Alyssa, the name of a queen. His Stormborn were all capable riders, at least. Carthus was a land of horse lords and pirates, where people routinely climbed off a horse and stepped directly onto a ship. They'd bought cold-weather clothes and ponies in the markets on the coast before setting out for the capital city, Felsmarch. Still, the northern winds seemed to drive right through wool and leather. Snow and sleet stung their exposed skin like a sandstorm at home. Evan considered using his magic to improve the weather, but decided against it. It was one thing to stir up a favorable wind at sea. He did not understand this weather, or this terrain, and he worried that tampering with it might have unexpected consequences, like the dangerous snowslides they called avalanches. But, with every frustrating delay, Evan worried that the Empress was launching her invasion of the Wetland Realms. The seas had once seemed boundless, a place where a gifted pilot with a good ship could lose himself. Now, all of his horizons seemed to be shrinking. Eventually, he'd be cornered. Celestine's words came back to him, from the day they'd first met, when she and Captain Strangward were arguing about the Mage Mart.
They're mine. They are a part of the Nazari line. They were created for a purpose, and it's time they served.
That was the most honesty he'd ever had from her. Usually her words were as sweet as prickly pear jelly. The Empress always looked at Evan with a mixture of greed, lust, envy, and desire. The only thing missing was love. The sea had always offered him the illusion of freedom, but now it was dissipating like a wetland mist. Some nights, despite his exhaustion, he played the game of, where is she now? Other nights, it was memories of Destin that kept him awake. Evan had left Destin behind in Arden's court. The soldier had claimed that he could be of more use to Evan in the capital than at his side. How was he faring in that nest of vipers to the south?
Had he made any headway in persuading the boy king that the Empress in the East was a greater danger than the Queen in the North? I don't want you to be of use to me, Evan thought, for the 100th time. I want you to forget about me. I want you to kill that monster of a father, leave Arden, and find another house by the sea. I want you to be happy. Yet, he couldn't help wishing they were facing these challenges together. It would be worth it, even for a short while. It seemed that the fates had decreed that he go through life alone. The heavily fortified border town of Delphi seethed with activity. Word had come that the northern passes had finally opened, and the traders, brokers, and travelers who had been bottled up there all winter prepared to journey on. The coal mines and foundries of the queendom had been producing all winter, and now wagon after wagon took the road north. Evan and his party joined a band of travelers on horseback, with a weather-beaten upland trader to serve as guide. It was a good military road when it wasn't chin-deep in snow, with stone and steel bridges where it crossed and recrossed the rivers and streams, roaring with snowmelt. Every night, travelers packed into bare-bones lodges situated a day's ride apart. First arrivals claimed the bunks that lined the walls. The less fortunate slept shoulder to shoulder on the floor. One night, a blinding snowstorm gave notice that winter wasn't quite finished in these mountains. The next day, teams of ponies dragged huge blades over the road, scraping the deep snow away. The tracks of wolves were everywhere, and their howling sometimes woke Evan in the night. Even with so much company on the road, he couldn't shake the feeling that he and his crew were being watched every step of the way by malevolent eyes. As their journey neared its end, they encountered small bands of uplanders, men and women, hair done up in braids and armed to the teeth. This, apparently, was how the North welcomed newcomers. After a long conversation with their guide and a hostile look-over, they were allowed to move on. At long last, one afternoon, they rounded a shoulder of a massive peak to see the vale spread out before them. The clouds they'd seen earlier had cleared somewhat as the day warmed, though steam rose from several large fissures in the near distance. Here, the air was noticeably warmer and moist, with a faint scent of sulfur. The valley was amazingly green for late winter. A river cut through the vale, tumbling out of the mountains in a series of waterfalls. At the north end of the vale, snuggled against the mountains, was the city of Felsmarch, their destination. They descended into the vale, striking north across the relatively flat terrain. As they drew closer to Felsmarch, Evan could see that the builders had made good use of the materials all around them. It was a city built of stone, but a very different stone from what Evan was used to. At home, buildings were built of buff-colored sandstone and stucco. Here, there was more variety. Sandstone, yes, but also granites and limestone. The town itself was a warren of steep, twisting, cobbled streets, with scarcely a level place big enough to pitch a tent, unless it was in the middle of the way. The skyline boasted a number of pretty spires, temples probably. Evan had half expected to see mages everywhere, but there were few abroad on the streets of the capital. On the positive side of the ledger, he saw no sign that the Bloodsworn had infiltrated this far inland. As other travelers peeled off to individual destinations, Evan spurred ahead so that he could converse with their guide, a man of few words and fewer smiles.
"Where are all the mages?" Evan said, as they turned onto a cobbled street that ran next to the river.
"They tend to stay on Grey Lady," the trader said, motioning toward a peak to the north, with its head in the clouds. "They only descend into the vale for business and politics."
Ahead,
The graceful stone towers of a palace rose from high banks next to the river. Evan took a deep breath, releasing it slowly. The Wolf Queen within represented what might be his last hope for alliance and sanctuary. Their guide directed them to an inn he knew, just outside the castle close, then took his leave. Now that they were in the capital, Evan considered the best way to connect with the Felsian authorities. He'd told everyone along the road that they were emissaries from Karthus, representing shipbuilders, merchants, and smugglers who hoped to do business with the queendom. But he worried whether that device would be enough to earn him a face-to-face with a queen grappling with the demands of an endless war. He needed to speak with her directly. It wouldn't do to be handed off to a quartermaster or castle steward. That evening, he was sitting in the common room of the inn with Tezza and Brody, debating his next move, when a young woman entered, bringing with her a blast of snow and cold and the unmistakable blue-white glow of Majory. She drew his attention for other reasons, too. She looked more like a pirate than anyone he'd seen in the wetlands. Her hair was dyed black, streaked with blue, and her exposed skin was layered in tattoos and piercings. Her skin might have been fair underneath, but it was burnt by sun and wind. She also looked beaten down, exhausted, and sad, like the only survivor of a catastrophe. She looked around the taproom, her gaze lighting briefly on Evan and his two companions. Dropping her hat and gloves on the table next to theirs, she elbowed her way through the crowd at the bar.
"You're still here, Captain?"
the barkeep said, turning toward the kegs lining the wall without waiting for an order.
"I thought you'd left yesterday."
"The queen asked me to stay a little longer," the woman said. She stopped, cleared her throat.
"She still had some questions she wanted answered before I go."
Evan came instantly alert. This chance encounter might be a stroke of luck. This captain, whoever she was, could be his connection to the queen. The barkeep plunked two brimming cups down in front of her.
"Too bad," he said. "I know you're anxious to get back to your ship."
Even better, she was a mariner, maybe even a privateer working for the queen.
"At least maybe the weather'll be better when I head to the coast," she said, pulling out her purse.
The barkeep shook his head.
"On the house," he said. "We all appreciate what you're doing, ma'am."
Evan watched her carry the cups to her table and settle heavily into her seat. He raised his cup.
"Fair winds, following seas, and a safe harbor at journey's end,"
he said in common. It was the traditional sailor's blessing. She turned and studied him, her eyes narrowed, then took in Tezza and Brody as well.
"And the same to you."
She turned back to her ale.
"We are merchants from Karthus," Evan said. "We are on our way to meet with your queen to discuss the possibility of trade between our countries."
"Merchants, are you?"
The captain raised an eyebrow.
"Sort of,"
Evan said, turning his cup between his hands.
"You look like a wizard to me,"
she said, using the northern term.
"Sort of,"
Evan said again.
"And a pirate?"
"Sort of," he laughed. "Since you brought it up, you look a bit like a pirate yourself."
This time, he managed to break through her brusque resistance.
"I'm not a pirate," she said, "but I am a ship's captain."
She extended her hand.
"I'm Hadley de Villiers."
Her name was vaguely familiar, but he couldn't place where he'd heard it. He gripped her hand, and the sting of magic flowed between them.
"Lucky Ferris."
"Ferris?"
Her grip tightened before she let go.
"I was thinking of a different name."
"You must be thinking of a different pirate,"
Evan said, meeting her gaze.
"Really?"
she said.
"I could have sworn that you were Evan Strangward, known as the Stormcaster of the Indio."
Brody and Tezza shifted in their seats, their hands sliding toward their weapons. De Villieu noticed. He knew she did, but pretended.